I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening to the podcast edition of Dig Deep. What you're about to hear is the last 25 minutes or so of the live event that wasn't on the airwaves, so you're one of the special people that gets to listen to this. We produce Dig Deep at KAXE, KBXE. If this has become something that you listen to regularly, you learn something from, we sure could use your support. We are a small, independent, national public radio affiliate that does great programming, whether it is the conversations we get to hear with Chuck and Aaron, where two people, a liberal and a conservative, not only talk to each other civilly, but they listen to each other. If you're listening right now, you know what I'm talking about. You've been listening to this podcast. Be a member. $5 a month. Maybe you can, if you let us know that you want to become a sustaining member, where we regularly take your pledge out of your credit card, your bank account every month, you can get our brand new t-shirt. It's garnet in color. It says, "You dig?" question mark on the front of it. It's a very cool shirt, and it's a very good way for you to feel good about supporting conversations like Dig Deep with Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone. Go to KAXE.org to sign up to become a member now. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for coming out to our live Dig Deep event. We'll be doing more in the year to come. Right now, Chuck is talking about that I had just mentioned the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund that supports the conversation on Dig Deep. And he and Aaron talk more about what they thought the Legacy Fund would do and what it actually does in the state of Minnesota.
Voted against the Legacy Amendment.
So did I.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you said that, and I don't know if we're recording this or not, but,
yeah, we
but
are.
I will, you know.
Which is funny, because my show, my Great Northern Radio Show, was funded by it.
It's funded by it, right. Yeah. No, there's a lot of things. Wow. A lot of things that the girls have done have been funded by it. I think I voted against it because I felt like it was going to subsidize a bunch of DNR programs that probably should have been killed and not really do what it was supposed to do. And I've been pleasantly surprised by how much money has actually been spent on substantive things that have made people's lives better. So, yay.
Yeah. I agree. And it's funny that you mentioned why you voted against it, because I also voted against it, but for very liberal reasons.
Yeah.
Because I felt like if we're going to support these things, we should just support them with the general fund,
right,
and have a consistent, reliable source of income, and we shouldn't be segmenting our favorite things into little sales tax things in perpetuity,
right?
That we should fund them normally. But that being said,
such an idealist.
That being said, I know that certain things, certainly not just my show, but a lot of really cool stuff has been happening, particularly in rural Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the state ever would have funded those things if it was passed out of the legislature. Heck, they can't even pass anything out of the legislature.
Right.
So that is pretty cool.
It is. And I see states like California that have just totally messed up their everything with a referendum process. I don't know how we managed to do a couple of these things pretty well, but we did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does anyone have questions or comments? Yeah, hold on a second.
So we do have a microphone.
Yeah.
Because this is, it doesn't make for good podcasting to have questions shouted from the audience with nothing. So we do have a microphone, right?
Yeah. Mr. Fox has a question over here.
Yep.
Okay.
In the 8th district, how big of a deal is non-ferrous mining as you move away from White Lakes? So mm-hmm. North Branch, Bemidji, Brainerd, then in the rural parts or the extremities of the 8th, how important is non-ferrous mining?
Well,
do you want to talk? Or?
Yeah, I can say from Brainerd, it probably does not even register as an issue. It is never discussed. It's never asked about. It's not a question anybody really cares about. And if it's ever brought up, it's generally brought up in one of two ways. What are those crazy people on the range doing? And, you know, like why are they so up in arms about this? Or, my gosh, I love the Boundary Waters. Why are you trying to destroy it? That's the other kind of mm-hmm. way it comes up. But really, it hardly ever does.
And I think that it, of course, is just an obsession of anybody who lives on the east side of the Iron Range, particularly Hoyt Lakes and Bowabic and Aurora. These are towns, when LTV closed, that were just socked. And the feeling is visceral, emotional. But for those towns, Ely is another example, it's cultural. It is a survival battle. And so talking about, oh, we should take our time and make sure we do it right, and we should impose a few regulations to make sure they don't do things. Well, no, we can't even do that because this is our last chance. This is it's like saying, I'll give you a life preserver, you know, but you have to sing a little song first. Like, I'm not going to sing any song. Give me that life preserver. And that's the attitude in those towns. But as you get farther away, I think the rest of the range, Hibbing and West, the perception of the mining issue becomes a very important thing. I think what the non-ferrous mining issue people have done very adroitly is they've hooked their wagon to taconite. And, you know, at first, it was funny. It's funny, because I've been around the issue long enough now, I get to say things like that now, where at the beginning of this, the steelworkers, the United Steelworkers of America, were highly skeptical of the non-ferrous mines on environmental grounds. They were skeptical of the companies. They believed they'd be non-union companies who would try to come in and go without a union. And they also thought that this was dangerous in terms of the environment. And they were cool. Maybe not opposed, but they were not helping. And this was the steelworkers. Well, the mining industry advocates got together and decided, and the Iron Mining Association was a part of this, we're going to print up these signs. We support mining. Mining supports us. Originally printed by the Iron Mining Association. Well, those signs have come to become the visible emblem of the whole mining discussion. We support mining. Mining supports us. And they're not just talking about non-ferrous mining, but they're talking about iron mining too. In the public's mind, those issues were wedded together. And so now anywhere close to a taconite plant all the way west, I mean, you can see those We Support Mine. I saw one out in Cohasset. I've seen them out south of Grand Rapids here, places where there haven't been mines in a long time. And it's because of the perception of that issue more so than the fact that that'll dramatically affect our employment in Grand Rapids, for instance. I mean, I know people who work at MinTac who live in Grand Rapids, but... That's the issue. So outside of the range, and this is where it gets really interesting too, I wrote about this, Stuart Mills, two-time Republican nominee who barely lost to Nolan both those times, Stu Mills, I call him Stu now that Chuck called him Stu once.
Sorry, I'm like, I'm familiar.
He,
so.
You knew him from high school, yeah. So that's why he gets to do that. But Stu
yeah,
Mills...
Yeah, I didn't go there. There's another derivation of Stuart Stu. There's an even more familiar one that I didn't use on the air. So.
Okay, got it. Well, I'm not going there. I'm not. Yeah. Yeah. But Stu Mills wrote just recently. He wrote started a blog, which I totally identify with. You know, life's not going well, so you start a blog.
Right.
But anyway, he started this blog and he wrote a really fascinating piece sharing his experiences running for office as a Republican, going to Republican events in central Minnesota, all conservative people, ain't nobody there a liberal, ain't nobody voting DFL, all conservative, who when he watched one of the governor candidates rail on non-ferrous mining and we support mining and I'm going to keep these mines going, these voters not only... It's not that they didn't care. They weren't responding to the message. They didn't, they like, wait a minute, what about my hunting habitat? What about my lakes where I go fishing? You know, that's what they were cued in on. So in a way, outside, I always say, like, this is an important issue. We have to get it right. I'm really excited about some stuff I've been working on for some columns and some material coming out this summer because I think there are really cool things environmentally we can do to make, to clean up the range and make things good. But on the other hand, we're not having those conversations. It's this cultural back and forth. So we put this issue, it's the only thing, when TV calls me, wants to interview me for color, it's about mining. It's about the environmental mining debate. Therefore, when a DFL candidate announces for office, when Michelle Lee announced, all she did was put out a mining statement. She didn't even have... You know, much else. It was, you know, and that's the thing that you're expected to do.
Well, and when you pointed out...
Sorry, I talk like a Muppet when
no,
I get
No, you
excited.
Pointed out, and I think this is very true. Republicans have the opportunity to be pragmatists on mining because they can just be silent on it.
They don't have to say a thing.
They don't have to say a thing.
Yeah.
And then when they get elected, they can actually be kind of pragmatic about it. Like, well, yes, I'm
well,
for
they could.
Mining.
they no. could, but I don't know if they will.
When I brought up in the live segment here, and some of you had a reaction to this, when I said the outside message is more calibrated for the Republicans than the DFL, this is one of those issues. Because if you look at the swing voters, which is really what those outside messages are trying to do, is move that swing voter to one camp or the other. If you look at the 8th as a whole, or you look at, you know, the Brainerd area or what have you, and you come in and you bomb it with a message of, you know, the Republicans are for mining and they're going to destroy the environment and they're for lifting all these environmental regulations and what have you. I don't know as that moves a lot of people from Republican to DFL in the 8th district. But it certainly signals to a lot of DFLers that this is like the big issue, you know, for the DFL. And maybe if I really care deeply about mining, I better go vote Republican. And that's why I said I feel like the outside messages are more calibrated to move voters into the Republican camp than the opposite, especially in this particular election campaign.
I just think about like my, well, I should say a relative. I'll just put it that way. I don't want to get into specifics. But they voted for Paul Wellstone, and then they voted for Donald Trump years later. And they think the party left them.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't understand that. You know, and it's not that, it's the cultural side of this. When you look at the very skillful propaganda that you see, like for instance, we all read the mine section in the local newspapers. That one company owns them all. They run the mine section. It's a big industry trade paper, basically, for the mining industry. And hey, I respect the mining industry and miners, and I am interested in some of the articles. But what it says under mine is "quote unquote" in quotes, "our way of life," is what they say. If you look at that section, that's a cultural argument. That they have equated, and you watch, like, if you go to the PolyMet environmental hearings and you watch the pro-mining citizens come up and give their testimony, they talk about, you know, we've fished in these waters for four generations, and we've hunted in these woods for four generations, and Papa worked at the mine, and the whole thing. And they're equating whether or not we have a sulfate standard with whether or not Junior gets to go fishing. You know, and that's a, you know, if Junior can't go fishing, you're going to lose, you know, and that's, but it's not the real choice. It's the choice we're
right,
given.
Right. It's the emotional choice. Yeah. Go ahead.
Any
sorry,
other
more Muppet
questions?
Talk from me.
Comments from anyone?
Yes. More
Chris,
questions.
There we go.
Fantastic.
A deeper question. Sitting around yesterday evening with a couple of Scandinavians having a conversation. And Europeans love to follow, obviously, our politics, but they couldn't get over the fact that
you mean like a real Scandinavian?
Oh, yeah. Guess at that.
Not
guess
us.
Our two Swedish young ladies, university folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got a number of political parties, and they can't understand how we can only have two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I go with your comment. I mean, my dad is a very active Republican. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he would recognize the Republican Party right now.
Right.
So just big world picture, what's it going to take to find for a party to pop up in the middle? Because the other two are going to the extremes. I mean, any thoughts on that? What's going to have a party pop up in the middle?
We actually did a whole show on
the
this notion of
parliamentary system.
Because we have, in a sense, at every level of government, state and federal in particular, we have a winner-take-all system. And so you are either a winner and in the governing position, or you are the loser. And what that does is it essentially it promotes the people who are losers to try to create a coalition of people and bring one over and become the winner. And it really, I think from my background in math and physics, if you run this out to infinity, what it does is it creates every incentive to have a party be at 50% of the vote. So you look and say, what type of issues do we have to piece together 50% plus one? And so what you wind up with is two crazy parties.
Yeah.
at 50% plus one. That's very different than a parliamentary system. And go ahead, I think we had a really good discussion about parliamentary systems and whether they would be a preferred option or not. Yeah. I know you've...
Well, the big difference is that in a parliamentary system, you have a party that matches very closely what you want. So if you're conservative, you get to ask yourself, am I a conservative because I'm a libertarian? Am I a conservative because I'm a social issues voter? You know, and those might be
am
different
Am I religious?
Things.
Am I anti-immigrant? Yeah. Like, what is my deal?
Yeah, what do I want? And I might have two or three options as a conservative voter. As a liberal, am I liberal because I'm a labor person? Am I a union person? Or am I liberal because I'm an environmentalist? Or am I liberal because I believe in social issues and progressivism in that sense? And you, maybe I want to have a totally milquetoast moderate party for the folks who just can't make up their mind. And then there'd be like 6-7 parties, and so I can pick my party and vote for them, and they're not going to get 50%, but if they get 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 representatives in a legislative body, then after the election, you need to get the 50% to govern. And so the top vote-getter gets to negotiate. If the top vote-getter is that milquetoast moderate party and they got 25% of the vote, they got to decide whether they're going to work with the Labor Party maybe and maybe the Libertarian Party or maybe the Social Conservatives and give them a few issues that they want, or maybe we work with the Progressives. So they can make those decisions after, and those parties can negotiate for policy they want. Case in point, when...
Let me give a really good recent example. In Italy, right now, last month, they elected basically the far left and the far right, and they formed a governing coalition. And it's a really strange, odd governing coalition because you have their two of their flanks are a basic minimum income and lowering taxes and putting up restrictions on immigrants.
Only in Italy can you do that.
Only in Italy, right. That's the kind of thing that happens at the end of the day.
But you can secure a policy outcome. So like if there's an environmental caucus, and let's say having a firm sulfate standard from perpetuity is in Minnesota going to be our goal, or even putting a moratorium on... Heck, why stop there? Put a moratorium on copper nickel. And if you can then make a deal with other parties to include you in the governing coalition, you might not get much else, but you might get your one policy outcome that you want. Or if you're part of a pro-mining Iron Range separatist party, you could say, we'll join your coalition. Here's what you do. Tommy Rukavina is our king now, and... we have a defined governance district, and you leave us alone, which is what a lot of, like in Great Britain, you have the Scottish Nationals and others that can do things like that. But you get something from after the fact. Now, what we do in America is we make those coalitions before the election. And so supposedly labor and the environment and everybody is on the Democratic side, and supposedly they're all going to get something if they win.
If you vote Republican, we're going to get rid of Obamacare. We already voted against it three times, or we're going to stop
immigration, or we're going to stop abortion, or we're going to do something that your party that you want. But the thing is, then the party wins.
Even then if they you have win, to do it.
Even if you win all three, if you win the executive branch and the legislative branch and you hold a majority in the judicial branch, which is what we've got right now, a lot of conservative policies right now are stuck because they still don't have the votes or they don't want to risk losing an election.
Here's I think, the interesting historical part of our two-party system. What our system is really designed to do is very little, and do very little very slowly. It is designed, our government is designed to be a minimalist government. And what we have done, and we can argue over whether this was a good thing or a bad thing, what we did really in the progressive movement through the Great Depression and the New Deal and then through the Great Society is we said we're going to have a very active government that's going to do a lot of things. And back in those days when there was a lot of money, there was a lot of affluence, things were very easy. Like I've said many times, when the problem became not how do we split one loaf of bread three ways, but how do we create two more loaves and everybody can have one? I mean, it's an easy problem when things are growing and there's money to spend. Now, what we're trying to do is take a situation where there's actually less, where there's more, I think, kind of difficult issues to solve because we've created these big messes. We don't have the flexibility now in our system to change policy. What happens in America, and we can see this because the founders had this problem too around slavery. Slavery was this big existential issue that they could not solve. And so they came up with all these just weird workarounds, the Missouri Compromise, the Three-Fifths Compromise, all these kind of...
The Senate.
Yeah, the Senate, yeah. All these kind of bastardizations of governance to get around this notion of, like, we can't make a decision here. And what happened was, ultimately, the cognitive dissonance between both parties and reality became so great that the Republican Party was born. And it got enough votes to actually win an election. And then what happened is the Whig Party went away. Like, it just, it because we have a two-party system. You're either a winner or a loser. And so if when you were a Whig, you were not going to be the Democrat Party. They were the secessionists. And you were either going to go Republican or, you just went away. Your party disappeared. We're now in this position where we have, again, these existential issues. The debt and the deficit. Healthcare. We could go down housing, transportation, the size of government. We have all these huge existential issues. And they don't lend themselves to a winner-take-all system. My argument has been, we have to get rid of those. We've got to put those issues down at the state where we can deal with them. The counter argument, and this is kind of Aaron's argument put together, is that we need a more flexible parliamentary system where we can vote for coalitions of people who can cross over and solve these problems. I think we have to have one or the other, because having huge complex problems with an inflexible governance system just is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for revolution and tumult is what it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't want to say we're heading to a revolution, but we're heading to an ineffectual place where, I always say this country has, it's going to truck along just fine until one day the Diet Coke truck won't come.
It breaks.
You know, because the Diet Coke truck didn't come to the grocery store that day for some reason. Society will break down, and it'll happen quickly. And I don't just mean Diet Coke. Maybe it's Twinkies or the Big Macs or
no,
something.
But things will
but
stop
But people
working.
Will start to say, right. Like, wait a minute. I don't. This whole world that I've lived in is an illusion, you know. Wait a minute. We've got a dysfunctional government. Wait a minute. We can't pass a budget out of the legislature. Wait a minute. The Supreme Court is doing whatever, you know, they want. It's not really based on a coherent law. And then you're just throwing garbage cans through windows because, and I'm joking a little,
no,
but not really.
I'm totally with you there. Because what happens in a system like ours is you either have, you know, and I think you can look at Thomas Jefferson's election as a revolution in this country. It was a revolution against an aristocracy. It was like our first real governance revolution. The second one was Abraham Lincoln, and that resulted in a civil war. I do not think we go to war if California secedes tomorrow. I don't think we mobilize troops and go there and fight Californians to keep them in. I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't send Chloe to do that. That seems ridiculous to me. I think a third revolution happened. It was maybe a longer, slower one, the Progressive Revolution, that kind of FDR maybe was the tipping point in that,
yeah,
the
yeah.
Great Depression.
It was building to that point.
And right. I feel like we are now at a point where there's so much friction that there's got to be a change. Is that change going to be a revolution like a Jeffersonian one where we just have like, okay, there's going to be a third party and a third governing philosophy that one of the other two will essentially merge and we'll have a third one. And in my mind, that would be a more localist one. I don't know what it would be, but in my mind, that's what it is. Or are we going to have what a place like the Weimar Republic had, which is we've got two extremes. Neither of them can solve the problem. We're forced to choose between one crazy or another crazy. And we all have to pick our poison every 4 years. And at one point, the existential threat of the other crazy becomes so much that the one crazy you voted for says, we're just going to do away with that crazy. And that's the way that governments like ours fail. And that's the way they've always failed throughout history. And I think I'm not like an advocate for moderate voices. Like I'm not one who says we all have to like hold hands and get along, and you know we should just split the baby. If you want 5 and I want 3, we should agree on 4. That's not me. But I do think that what we have to do is we have to change our tone of conversation so that we don't automatically demonize the other, because that's going to lead us to that no choice kind of, you pick your crazy on one side or the other.
All right. Well, thank you guys. Thanks for coming. Thanks to those of you listening.
You are
on the podcast?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Because I mean, here's the thing. Like, I could stay here all night and do this.
You can come up. But if you're listening on the podcast, thanks for doing that. We also need your support. Topics. Send us an email. Comments at kexe.org. They both are okay with negative comments.
Send us those emails that says,
cool.
I know who gets
really
more
love
of them too.
Yeah, I really love Aaron. He's so good on the air. But that Chuck, he just makes me angry. What did he mean when he said this or that? And you've got this like list of things we have to go through at
right,
some point.
We'll do that later.
Yeah, this is actually unusual.
It was hard
unusual.
To figure. We didn't want to make them uncomfortable.
Usually we sit across from one another.
Yeah, so it's a little awkward. But
neither one of us wanted to show our backside to the crowd. Uh-huh. And you didn't want that anyway.
No, exactly. I do think it's important. There's a lot of people I know who listen to this who are not in the KXE listening area. And they don't get often the member drive stuff.
Right.
You know, like you can go to kxe.org and sign up to become a member. It's an important thing.
Because you guys are modeling good behavior. This is not happening where people are talking to each other like this. And we are getting people from Washington, from all across the country that are signing up for the podcast and are listening and are sending us comments. So we should be proud, again, of the state we live in and that we are modeling some good behavior that you can talk to people who have different political views than you do. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Thanks everybody.
And thank you, Chloe, for being here.